session number 27073, Reel 7.
Reel 7. Obviously, with this changing role, your own personal work within the squadron would change. Could you please tell me how you would plan an operation and how you would control that operation from in the air?
Yes. There are two ways of tackling this question. One was, what did our headquarters say to us during various phases? Because don't forget, sometimes we were in hasty retreat, and secondly, we were in a stationary mode, like Alamein, where there was a set frontal system that we knew intimately. And then the final phase of these battles, and I was involved in one of them, was the advance of the 8th Army into Tunisia. We were chasing fleeing Afrika Korps units. So therefore, the method of control was by headquarters, the headquarters of the Desert Air Force, which is a very small headquarters, and we were rung up by the controller saying we would like you to be at a readiness state. We don't know what is happening tomorrow, or we have the following targets that we want attacked, or we will inform you of what we'd like you to do as the day progresses. So we were very flexible fighting force, and we never really knew unless we had information the night before of what the targets could be. If it was a set target for a dawn patrol, that was quite simple. We just found out where the unit was that they wanted us to attack, such as an Afrika Korps or an Italian headquarters, or a build-up of their transport or tank build-ups, etc., etc., etc. If it was one of those targets, we were told how many airplanes, whether it was a squadron attack or whether it was a wing attack. And if it was a wing attack, I'd ring up my opposite number, and we'd decide who was going to lead. One day I would lead, next day. I flew with number 3 Australian squadron with Bobby Gibbs, who was a great mate of mine, and we used to take it in terms who was going to lead the two squadrons. If it was myself who was going to lead, I'd work out the course to be flown without any meteorological information, but we had a fair idea of what the wind was. And funnily enough, those who've flown over the desert say, well, what landmarks did you have? How did you navigate? Well, it was quite simple that you had some very definite landmarks. First of all, on your right-hand side, you had the sea. And on the left-hand side, you had the Qattara Depression. So the desert in between, which could be anything from 40 miles wide to 120 miles wide, were splattered by camel tracks that had been going for thousands of years. You had dried salt lakes. You had ridges of small mounds which stayed there for years. So you had quite a few definite landmarks. And of course, you had the railways, you had the main road set up from Alexander right up to Brook and elsewhere. So your navigation wasn't all that difficult, and of course, invariably it was perfect weather, and I only suffered bad weather about twice in the whole period I was out there, and that was heavy rain, and we didn't fly in those conditions.
So you would work out the course, you'd take account of the weather. Would you then brief your pilots as to what they had to do?
Oh yes, you always brief the pilots, no matter which theatre you were in. You get them all together and say, this is the job to do, just follow me. It was one easy way of doing it. Or you'd go into detail, and if it was a wing thing, you'd get your opposite number to come along too, to discuss. He would then go back and say, this is what we're going to do, what we, 112 Squadron, if we were leading, what we intended to do, and he'd work out his tactics.
You mentioned the main threat, obviously, when you were doing your ground attack was the light flak. With the Germans, would that be heaviest around, say, airfields or artillery positions, that sort of thing, or would it be everywhere?
Well, airfields were very nasty, and you only did one attack and never a repeat attack, because that's where everybody got killed if they're going to get killed. And surprise was the essence of it. So ground attacks were always very carefully looked at before attack, and you had it very you usually had photographs of where the airplanes were, and the answer was you did one strafing attack, destroyed whatever you could on the ground, and then went home, got the hell out of it. Never a second attack. And that applied not only in the desert, but in Europe later on.
It's interesting because obviously at the start of you taking command, there was a lot of action around Gazala, and there was a number of attacks that you took on German airfields at that time. I believe there was a concentrated period where you were attacking German airfields to suppress their aircraft during that period. Do you have any memories of that concentrated period?
Yes, well, when I first arrived in the desert, we were on airfields just outside Tobruk. And so quite a few of the targets that we were involved with were attacking German units that were attacking Tobruk. And also their line, which is further, I'm not quite certain of where they were, but it was from, and I'll try and remember the names later on. Right, now, shortly after taking over the squadron, the first major target that I was given, and that included a force of two of our squadrons, was to attack an airfield, I've forgotten the name of it, where German 109s had been posted in from where, I have no idea, to support the Africa Corps that were about to attack the 8th Army west of Tobruk, and so the headquarters rang me up and said, look, three squadrons, the 109s, just landed at an airfield. I've forgotten the name, but they gave it to me, and I soon found out where that was, and would we go and deal with them next morning. So I rang up Bobby and said, look, this is the job I've been given. Are you quite happy? He said, yes. So we worked out the tactics that we would employ on this attack and destroy as many airplanes as we possibly could. And so we set off next morning at dawn, and there we found a good 30 to 40 109s not protected in any way. So it was open target for all of us, and we destroyed somewhere in the region of about 30 of these airplanes on the ground. And as a result of that, I got an immediate award of a DFC.
How had the Germans deployed them? Were they in lines, or were they?
They were in lines in this particular, and they didn't seem to have any ACAC or anything. So they were surprised.
It sounds to me that they weren't expecting any kind of ground attack.
No. It was easy meat as far as we were concerned.
I think as well, at some points, you actually you were involved with medium bombers as well, in the sense that you were operating with them. Mm. How did that work?
Yeah. By this time, particularly when we got back to Alamein, not before, when we got back to Alamein and before the 8th Army attack against the Afrika Korps at Alamein and the subsequent advance into Tripoli, the Middle East had quite a number of light bomber units, and they were detailed to deal with the Afrika Korps, and required fighter escort, and therefore quite a few of our trips were in that role of fighter escorting. Once again, it's a brand new role, so we weren't quite certain how to do it. And so my first thoughts were not to do what the Germans did in the Battle of Britain, sort of formate closely with the bomber forces, but to be in the area. And that was our method of protecting the light bombers, agreed by their commanders as well. And so it was a floating air cover. But very, very seldom did we come across air opposition.
I was interested, obviously, between that stage and you getting to the LLR main line, you had retreated. Is there a technique for moving the squadron, withdrawing the squadron backwards to another landing strip?
Yes. I don't know whether it was a technique. It was the method we used, and that was my adjutant and the other ground personnel dealt with the move of personnel and vehicles, because I the mobiles, we were a mobile unit there. A squadron transport system consisted of about 120 vehicles of every type, and troop carriers for our ground people. So the method was that if we were retreating, we would send an advance party with the majority of personnel and equipment not required for immediate 24-hour period to service the airplanes, and that just the pilots and the start-up crews would be left behind as the rear party, and as soon as we decided where we were going, we would wait for our last mission, tell the ground crew to go off, follow up their thing to such and such an airfield. And that's how it was. It was just done in two simple steps. The main party first, and then the rear party that was servicing the airplanes would go off last. And there'd have to be, obviously, an interim period where we were non-operational. But we kept that down to a minimum.
Would the targets vary, obviously, with when you were retreating or advancing? I mean, would there be something that they would emphasise to attack if once the Germans were advancing? Would you be against armoured columns or convoys rather than airfields and gun positions? Or something?
Yes. The majority of targets chosen and agreed on by all of us were transport units, the German transport units that were either bringing up replacement ammunition or fuel, and we would attack them. And so it was soft vehicles most of the time. Tanks, no, unless it was absolutely necessary. If there's a big build-up of tanks against our own things, we would be invited to bomb them and strafe them. But we weren't all that effective. As we later became very efficient in Europe with the rockets and the fully grown-up fighter support units.
I would have supposed, obviously, with the types of bombs that you were loaded with, it would be almost more realistic to kill the tank crews in strafing rather than
exactly,
being able to actually destroy the vehicles.
But we weren't asked often to do it. The only time we really went to town on those was at Beit Hakim in support of the Free French. The legionnaires who were defending Beit Hakim against the Africa Corps, and there we went for tanks because they were the ones who were doing all the damage. Yeah.
Was that relatively close support when you were helping with the Free French?
Oh, very much so. Yes, in fact, we had a ground unit with the Free French, and they were talking to us, say there is a danger point, and can you see it? Can you deal with it?
Would that be directly to yourself?
That would be directed to whoever was leading the formation. That was it became eventually in Europe known as the cab rank system. So we started that off in the desert.
This is interesting because obviously you mentioned the slightly changing role. Again, you had changed from this fighter interception role to taking command in the air. How easy was it when you were leading a formation to get the formation to do what you wanted them to do?
Right. Well, we had very good radio communication, aircraft to aircraft, and if there was a change in a set plan that we had decided on before takeoff, or if it was an ad hoc patrol where we were just told to patrol, given the information to deal with such and such a situation, I then very quickly had to decide how best to do it. Always, we were aware that the Germans still had fighters, so I always left a portion of my unit as a top cover against aerial attack. So the planning to be done was in my head, to do so and so. And then I talked to each pilot and said, this is what we're going to do. Can you by any chance see the target is there, such and such, at 9 o'clock, da da da, and behind that ridge? It looks like 16 vehicles. I'd like red section to stay above, give me air protection, and the other 8 aeroplanes, we will go in and attack. I will lead the attack, and blue section, you follow in, and so get into line astern, and we will, as soon as I'm in range of these targets, I'll go down and strafe them.
Obviously, it was quite a dangerous role, as you mentioned, because of the light flak. What type of casualties did the squadron take while you were commanding them?
It was very difficult to answer that one. It depended entirely on the size of the target, how well they were defended. I mean, for example, that little one of 16 vehicles that probably had no ground attack at all, apart from the soldiers there using their rifles. If it's a big build-up and been preordained as a start point by the German Africa Corps, you could have a target that consisted of thousands of vehicles, hundreds of tanks, and therefore hundreds of light ACAG. And so therefore you gave them a lot of thought before attacking them.
And what about you? As I say, your own casualties with that. Did you take casualties over that period?
No, because the way a good leader would lead ensured that casualties would be cut down to a minimum. So this question of never attacking an airfield again would apply to ground attack units that don't go on and on and on, because you just ask them to probably, and therefore it is always, what surprise can I engender into this particular mission? Do I use the sun? Do I come in low? Whatever. And therefore, the answer to your question depends very much, usually, on the knowledge of this type of operation of the squadron commander or the leader of that unit.
Sounds to me like you needed a very strange mixture of skills, in a sense. You had to be very flexible, but also you had to use the surrounding terrain, the sun, that sort of thing. How long would it take you to make those decisions?
It had to be instantaneous. It had to be. And only experience in this type of warfare would guarantee that leaders had this type of experience. Yeah, because later on, when I had a typhoon wing in Europe, the planning was always meticulous. And if you were on a cab rank system, you looked at the target area. You, with any luck, you knew where what type of target was, and you then use whatever cover you had to your advantage.
So, at that point then, from what you've said earlier about your service, where there was no discussion of tactics, with the idea of the pilot's messes and this developing role, would you have much more discussion with your pilots about how to do things?
In the pilot's mess, not necessary, because shop was discouraged. But having said that, you'd occasionally get the pilots together and say, look, we're all here now. I'd like to discuss the latest situation and to get your views on it, because I think that we're on the right lines, but have you got any comments to make on the tactics that we are employing? And that would start a conversation. But you only found a handful of more senior, particularly the senior NCOs, would pipe up and say, ba 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 ba, and you'd react accordingly and store it in your head. But we Scotland Guanas were all powerful and got on with the job, and as a result, you were either a successful squadron commander or you were asked to leave.
It sounds very much like the squadron was very successful in its role.
We were, I think, very successful in that. Well, I got practically all my decorations at that period. I got an immediate bar to my DOC and an immediate DSO. An immediate being that the commanders in chief were given. The job of distributing these things without asking the king or the home headquarters.
I was wondering, obviously, you know, you've been operating for quite some time in those conditions, and obviously quite a hectic schedule in the sense that you'd be operating daily or whatever. Mm. Did any of the pilots ever exhibit any form of strain during that period from those low-level attacks?
Yes. Time was the factor involved in all our make-ups. Some could go on flying and fighting for longer periods than others. And it was the job of the squadron commanders and the medical officers to get together periodically to discuss the state of any of the pilots involved. And if we thought between us that so-and-so was getting overconfident, usually overconfidence was our biggest thing. Most of us, to begin with, at a phase, were apprehensive, and we'd look at the thing. But then, as a period went on and on and on, you got very gung ho and let's go go. And these were the people that one gently took out and sent away either on holiday or on another job to recover, because it's stressful. But we didn't want people to kill themselves unnecessarily.
And what about yourself? Were you monitoring yourself, or was the medical officer monitoring you?
Military. The MO was obviously in contact with the headquarters, but the headquarters were also aware of the possible strain of their squadron commanders, because they only had, 10 squadron commanders, and they had a fair idea of the stray, and particularly in my case, I'd only been given this squadron, and then I was on a retreat, and that was on a retreat as a squadron commander. Not only were you leading practically all the flying sorties, but you were responsible for the move of the squadrons, and there was very little sleep. And I remember at one period, I was prevented by my warrant officer from shooting an airman who I thought was a coward. And he knocked my revolver out of my hand. And that was purely because I was tired, and I'd been without sleep for about 3 days or three nights. So that answers your... We did take note of the state of each pilot's ability to carry on.